that's the one we're putting up with. Join us in this great campaign for freedom and liberty. Thank you very much.
Train called freedom and America got on board. But a pocket full of bankers, well, they made that train go track. Now we need a leader who can get us back on course. Run, ball. He's a driving that freedom train, so climb on board. Well, she may have gone off track, but Ron Paul can bring her back. We're gonna hear that liberty whistle blow once more. A dollar worth its weight in gold will help let freedom ring. And every penny that you make belongs to you. Let's bring our soldiers home and leave the other trains alone. Ron Paul Freedom Train will see us through. Ron Paul, he's a driving that freedom train, so climb on board. Well, she may have gone off track, but Ron Paul can bring her back. We're gonna hear that liberty whistle blow once more.
All about freedom, prosperity, and peace. The Constitution was written very precisely to restrain the power and force of government and to protect the liberties of each and every one of us.
Ron Paul, he's a driving that freedom train, so climb on board. Well, she may have gone off track, but Ron Paul can bring her back. We're gonna hear that liberty whistle blow once more. Ron Paul. Ron Paul. Ron
Hi, this is Stephen Vincent, and thank you for joining me for this edition of the Freedom Message. So, there's lots of great news, interesting news, and great news today. Let's start with this. The New Hampshire primary has been moved up to January 8th. ABC News is reporting that New Hampshire Secretary of State Bill Gardner announced today that the state's primary will be held on January 8th, preserving its status as first in the nation. New Hampshire has held the first presidential primary in the nation since 1920, Gardner said, at the State House in Concord, New Hampshire. This tradition has served our nation well. The announcement ends months of speculation, as well as considerable maneuvering by party officials in other states. New Hampshire's primary comes just 5 days after Iowa holds its caucuses, setting up a post-holiday campaign blitz for the Republican and Democratic candidates. So, All that means is we still have to work harder to get ready for the caucus in Iowa and the primary in New Hampshire. Now, also, we have news from South Carolina. There's a new poll out, and it's a Rasmussen Report poll. Finds that both men earning 20... It finds that Mitt Romney and Fred Thompson are tied for the lead in the South Carolina's Republican presidential primary, with both men earning 21% of the vote from likely primary voters. That's a big change from September, when Thompson was on top with support from 24% and Romney trailed the frontrunner by 9 percentage points. Trailing the two leaders are Rudy Giuliani at 13%, Mike Huckabee at 12%, John McCain at 9%, and Ron Paul at 8%. That is, Ron Paul is up from 2% to 8%. Only a percentage point behind John McCain, only 3 percentage points behind Huckabee, and 4 percentage points behind Rudy Giuliani. These are the latest numbers in official polling from South Carolina. And we also have an important endorsement for Ron Paul. This is from a few days ago. Barry Goldwater Jr., of course, the son of the 1964 Republican presidential candidate Barry Goldwater, has endorsed Ron Paul for president. And Ron Paul was in Reno, Nevada recently. So I'm going to play a few clips for you. First, here's a crowd shots of Ron Paul in Reno, Nevada. It looks to be about 1,000 people gathered to hear him speak in Reno.
Ladies and gentlemen, Congressman Ron Paul.
So for radio listeners, you can only hear the crowd. You can't see it, unfortunately, but quite an enthusiastic reception for Congressman Ron Paul in Reno, Nevada. A room, I would guesstimate, about 1,000 people. It's a large, large room. Packed. And of course, view at www.ronpaulfreedommessage.com. If you'd like to view as well as listen, ronpaulfreedommessage.com.
There certainly has been a lot of enthusiasm with the campaign, and I am always so pleased with it being so positive and enthusiastic. And one of my instructions has been that if you join the campaign, we're supposed to have fun doing it. It looks like you are, and I appreciate that very much.
Good. So there we have Congressman Paul greeting the troops, as it were, in Reno, Nevada. Now an interview on KRNV-TV Nevada, Reno local television.
Okay, Congressman, for those who aren't familiar, who is Ron Paul, and describe yourself as a candidate?
Well, I'm an OBGYN doctor that ran for Congress and was elected in the 70s, reelected in the 90s after a spell of being out for 12 years. Now I'm running for the presidency on the Republican ticket to make sure that people hear a message of individual freedom and the Constitution, limited government, and a foreign policy which would end the war in Iraq.
You are making some waves. You are gaining in popularity, but you're still not up there with the top four. What do you need to do to be amongst those names?
Do very well in a very friendly state called Nevada. And we are doing fine, and that's why we're here. It's an early primary, and I think if we have a good showing here, a lot of people are going to pay a lot more attention. So we're working very hard here, as well as some of the other early primaries.
You're the only Republican candidate who voted against the war and still has a stance against the war in Iraq. Does that help you or hurt you as a Republican candidate?
Well, it helps me as an American candidate. I mean, it's a challenge in the Republican primary because not so much that they love the war, but they tend to want to be loyal to the party and loyal to the president. And I especially have to understand that in Texas, and I understand that. But when it comes to popularity, since 70-some percent of the people now want us home, it's a very, very popular position. What it does, it opens up the door to invite disgruntled Republicans who have dropped out a few years ago, independents and Democrats who aren't happy with their party. They're coming and joining us in our campaign, so it's a very powerful issue.
You're getting some strong support from a very boisterous group, the young people. Explain that and how it's helping your campaign.
Well, I've argued that we complain that our public school system's not very good and they haven't had a good education. But jokingly, but half serious, I say they've learned their arithmetic and they know what they're getting. They're getting a Social Security system that doesn't work and a war that's not going well and an entitlement system that they can't pay for. And they love the idea of personal freedom. They love the idea of rule of law and the Constitution. And young people have always led, quote, revolution, to significant changes. They're principled people, and they like the idea of standing on principle, and the young people have joined us.
How about the Internet, all the bloggers that are creating quite a stir on your behalf?
Well, sometimes they more or less carry the campaign or push the campaign because they raise money for us. It's all spontaneous. They volunteer. One day last week, we had one day where 20,000 new people signed up and sent money all in one day. And the Internet is a tool that has never been used like this in our history. Even 4 years ago, it wasn't used like this. And when young people get energized and they have a tool, it's a real political equalizer. So we can compete now with the powerful special interests who collect millions and millions of dollars for the other candidates because they have a special interest to serve. In this case, we have a special interest. That's individuals who are banding together for different reasons, but they come together for one thing. They'd like to be left alone, and they endorse the ideas of freedom.
You ran as a libertarian in 1988. Why the switch to Republican?
I don't think of it as a switch because I've been elected 10 times to the Congress as a Republican. I was in the Libertarian Party and ran as a Libertarian in 1988, so I don't think of it so much as a switch. I still have close association with the Libertarian Party. I think the Founding Fathers were Libertarians. I think everybody believes in liberty, and that's what Libertarianism is. The reason that it's better to run in a major party is the laws are biased against any third party, whether it's left, right, or center. It's real hard to get on ballots. You can't get in debates. Unfortunately, we don't have as much democracy here as we pretend to have, and so we're limited. And if you come to the conclusion that Republicans and Democrats aren't all that much different, it's sort of a shame. But right now, the vehicle available to me is to be in the party that I have that I've been elected in, you know, for these past 20 years.
Mm-hmm. One last question here. You have created a stir. Your numbers are gaining. What stance do you think is going to keep the momentum going?
I think, in general, it's just the idea of freedom and limited government and fiscal responsibility, but the attention getter is the foreign policy, because I can save money by bringing our troops home and we can end the war. And if we save enough money there, we really can tide over so many people here at home that are hurting, and some of the programs that aren't perfect, but at least we don't want to put people out in the street here at home, but we can save literally hundreds of billions of dollars by changing our foreign policy.
Okay, Congressman.
It's a nice interview with Congressman Paul in Nevada. The buzz seems to be pretty good in the state of Nevada, and like New Hampshire, Nevada appears to have a reputation as being somewhat of a libertarian-leaning state. So not familiar with the poll numbers there, but the word from Nevada seems to be pretty good. Let's go ahead and listen to this interview with a reporter from the Reno Journal newspaper.
What's your reaction to this following that you both built and that has kind of grown organically around your campaign?
It's been surprising.
Yeah.
Because I was very skeptical of becoming a candidate. As a matter of fact, I was very reluctant, and I tell all my supporters that.
Yeah.
I said, but they claim I have limited their apathy, and I said, well, you have eliminated my skepticism about people not, and I tell all my supporters that.
Yeah.
Turns out a lot of people did, and they were hoping somebody would come along, and they had dropped out a long time ago or never been involved. At the same time, the young people who may be just hearing it for the first time are receiving the message in a very positive fashion. So that's very encouraging, and the message is spreading through the Internet. So the credibility came from the enthusiasm on the Internet, which not only was translated into doing very well in the post-election polling, which we were always said, oh, no, that was just gimmickry, that you guys know how to use the Internet, and there weren't very many of us. And then all of a sudden, when they saw a one-day fundraising event of 37,000 people sending money and 20,000 brand new people, all of a sudden there was a lot more credibility given to us in our campaign.
Mm-hmm. Why were you so reluctant to become a candidate?
I didn't think there were enough people. There was no doubt in my mind about the message. I know my shortcomings in my presentations, and I don't brag about me being the greatest messenger in the world. So, but I'm never doubtful about the message, because I know it's what has made America great, and it's not my message as much as the traditional American message of freedom. But I was skeptical and believed that there would be enough enthusiasm, and it took a fair amount of convincing for me to do it. And then it was sort of a token effort to see what would happen. And yet the announcement, I should have known something was going to happen, because the announcement was sort of leaked by accident. Mm-hmm. And even the announcement spread like wildfire. That's when I first had my real introduction into the Internet, how quickly things move. Then literally thousands of people started responding, and we didn't even have an office.
Mm-hmm.
And one person, and I sort of made the decision, and so he was the only one that was employed with me, even though we had two or three advisors who were arguing the case for doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the campaign has always been ahead of the organization.
Mm-hmm. You refer to your message a lot. I'm wondering if you think it's being accurately portrayed by the media, or is it being kind of stereotyped? And if you could just state, what is your message? What do you hope people learn?
I think they've done a pretty good job. You do have some people, the editorial writers and those who strongly oppose the message, really, really, that the further along we get, the sharper the criticism comes, and it gets at times pretty ugly, and they become, I guess, fearful that they may lose their control because they are all those special interests. My message is very simple. And it is that we should obey the rule of law. The rule of law is very, very important, and the Constitution is the rule of law. If you can ignore the Constitution in one area, there's nothing left. And if you can go to war without a declaration, how can you expect them to defend the Second Amendment or the First Amendment or the Fourth Amendment? And the Fourth Amendment isn't obeyed because our prophecies are essentially disappeared. And my message is, you obey the Constitution. Fortunately for me and our followers, we think freedom solves the problems rather than government, and the Constitution is on our side of that, or we're on the side of the Constitution, because the founders were very libertarian. They believed in personal liberty and free markets and sound money. So it all comes together, and now that our problems are becoming overwhelming, people are looking for answers, and I think they're finding the answer in this philosophy of limited government.
Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about a few Nevada-specific issues. 90% of the land here is owned by the federal government. I'm wondering how you would approach that as president, and what your views are on the Yucca Mountain nuclear waste dump.
My basic principle is that overall, the more land owned by the people, the better. Texas came into the Union and 99% of the land was owned by individuals. And you know, energy and all was developed rather well in Texas, and we still have very, very small amount of federal land. So I would my goal would always be to privatize land, never allow the government to take in more land. And in general, I would like to see as much land, if not all the land, turned over to the states. If you wanted to save all the very special national parks for a later debate, that'd be fine. So I imagine in this state, you could talk about 90% of federal land ought to be turned over to the states. Yucca Mountain, on the very early, I've been involved in many votes on this. There were times when there were only three votes to not allow the federal government to dictate to the state and bring nuclear waste and put them in this state. And I voted. I was one of the three. The other two were the congressman from this district that was from the state that was protecting the state's rights that shouldn't happen. And ironically, I'm from Texas. I have a nuclear power plant in my district. They want a place to put their waste, and I voted against it, you know, because I don't believe, you know, constitutionally we shouldn't be dictating, you know, to this state. And I don't think it's actually necessary to have one site. We've been storing nuclear waste in my district right on the plant site, and they could, and it's done for 35 years and hasn't been a problem, and they probably could adapt. Texas is a pretty big state, you know, and I'll bet you we could find a place to deal with that safely enough. It's dangerous, but it's not nearly as dangerous as they make it out to be, but to force Nevada to take that is absolutely wrong.
Mm-hmm. Right. If you don't win the Republican nomination, will you make a third-party independent bid for the presidential?
No plans whatsoever to do that.
No plans now. Okay.
Tried that before. The system is biased against competition with the two major parties. It's very costly, not Ross Perot when it comes to money. And right now we're concentrating on what we're doing, and we're certainly having an impact. And when you think about how significant the state of Nevada might be, you know, winning in Nevada might be a lot more significant than getting 37,000 people to donate money in one day.
Mm-hmm. And could you talk a little bit about your opposition to the Iraq war? Is this a popular view you're running into among Republican primary voters?
No, it's more it's challenging in the Republican primary because it's not so much that they love war, because they certainly opposed the war when Clinton was doing it. And Bush, you know, ran on a no nation building and a humble foreign policy and no policeman of the world, so I'm on his program. Mm-hmm. Republicans tend to be partisan, and they tend to be loyal to the president, so it's a harder row to hoe there, you know, to get the Republican primary voters to support my position. But a lot of them do. Certainly the Republicans that have dropped out are in my camp on this. The independents are, the Democrats are, and the Democrats are unhappy with their answers. So, and statistically, 70% of the American people want the war to end and would go along with my policy. The big challenge, of course, is do you have 70% in the Republican primary? And we really don't. Mm-hmm. But we have more every single day. If they come to realize that if they want to win, Republicans want to win, they better change their foreign policy. They better go back to George Bush's foreign policy that he won on in the year 2000.
Another interview with Congressman Paul in Reno, Nevada. Now, Congressman Paul did have something to say about the recent raid on the Liberty Dollar offices, which, of course, I've reported on here extensively. And let's listen to his comments about that. I believe this was from yesterday.
Company offices of the group manufacturing the Ron Paul Liberty Dollar, they took all their physical gold, their physical silver, their client records, their computer records. Obviously, they're not associated with your campaign, but you have to have some sort of opinion or position on what happened last week.
What I know about it is I've read in the newspapers, and I have been an advocate, and I've already mentioned, I want competing currencies, but I suspect what has happened is that the government doesn't want competing currencies, and there's going to be a charge made that they were trying to undermine the legal tender laws. Well, I don't even believe that we should have legal tender laws. The market should decide what is money, and if you have any force, it should only be gold and silver. So ironically, there's an attempt to use gold and silver. The government wants to protect their monopoly over artificial money, and now we have this major undertaking. The details, I don't know the people. I don't know. I didn't read what the charges were. I don't know what will happen.
hopefully the best thing that can come of it is a real, honest constitutional debate in court about what money is and what the dollar is and what the government ought to do with money. But if these individuals were actually practicing civil disobedience, peaceful civil disobedience, they can be constitutionally correct, legally wrong, just as Martin Luther King was. I mean, these are worthy things to do. But if you do it, you have to have full knowledge that the arm might of the government is still pretty strong, and you might end up in jail practicing civil disobedience. So I'd like to change things, but my option has always been to try to change the law, whether it's the tax code or the monetary system, and others do it in other ways, but they have to realize what the consequences could be.
So they have to realize what the consequences could be. Some interesting comments from Dr. Paul. I find it hard to believe that he doesn't know much about the situation. I think there's just a little bit of politics being played there. Naturally, he's got to distance himself from any kind of potentially explosive situation. But, he more or less supports the position of resisting unjust laws. So I don't think that there's anything that I have seen yet. I mean, I'm open-minded. If someone can show me the law that Liberty Dollar in fact violated some law, some constitutional law, I'm not even aware that they've violated an unconstitutional law from what I have been able to gather thus far. And it's kind of interesting that nobody, including experts such as Dr. Paul, can be clear on whether there has been a violation of law, whether constitutional or not. There seems to be a lot of, lack of clarity on these points. And I certainly enjoy getting some kind of in-depth examination of the relevant constitutional and unconstitutional laws with regards to this case, and I'll certainly see what I can do about getting that. We do look to have Mr. Bill Murphy on the show next week sometime. He has committed to coming on, and he's someone who's an expert in the realm of gold and silver, and perhaps he may be able to enlighten us to some degree on these legal tender currency laws that are relevant to the case. Now, Mr. Von Nothaus did have an opportunity to sort of defend himself on the Kudlow show on CNBC, and let me play that for you now.
The Liberty Dollar and its founder under criminal indictment by the U.S. government, all they want to do is end the Fed and just gold into our money. Joining me now is the creator of the Liberty Dollar, Bernard Von Nothaus. Bernard, welcome. This is kind of an interesting story to me. What's wrong with putting a little gold and silver behind our coins?
Hey, listen, that's what the U.S.
So one of these guys, they busted your operation up in Indiana? They just came in and raided it? What'd they do that for? Under what charge?
Well, the thing is that that's what we're asking. You know, we don't understand what we're doing wrong, and we've been doing it for 10 years, Larry. And the government's been very benign. They've even commented that what we're doing is legal. But last Wednesday, they burst in with about a dozen G-boys, walked in there and just bagged everything, all the gold, all the silver, all the computers, all the records, everything.
Just because it's you got a little gold. Are these coins themselves gold and silver?
Well, they're not coins because a coin is something issued by the government. And we're not the government, Larry. But yes, they're pure gold, they're pure silver, and we also have paper, and it's also in digital form. In answer to your question, I think what was really bad was how successful we were becoming, Larry.
Well, so you're basically, these are investments is what they are, right? You're not actually saying these are coins.
Well, we're not saying they're coins, but they're not investments either. This is a functioning currency. Over $20 million in circulation, been around almost 10 years, a couple hundred thousand people using the currency, Larry. Even though we are the second most popular currency in America, we do have a bit of upside potential here for the Liberty Dollar.
Well, I don't know why people aren't free to choose. If they want to circulate your coins or your paper, they should be free to do that. I think that is against the law. I'm just saying in a perfect world, they should be free to choose.
Well, we are free to choose. We live in a free economy. There is no law against owning gold and silver or using gold and silver whatsoever at all. We've never misrepresented the product, Larry. We've never said it's legal tender. Matter of fact, we built our whole campaign on the fact that it is not legal tender. It's a private, voluntary barter currency.
So what happens? Are you yourself going to jail? Are we going to be the last people to see you out of jail?
God, I hope I can make it home after this interview, Larry.
You're getting a lot of visibility tonight, my friend. You sure this was wise? Did you talk to your lawyer?
Yes, I have. Matter of fact, I talked to my lawyer after we read the sealed, quote-unquote, sealed 35-page affidavit that the FBI agent filed with the judge to get the search warrant. Mm. And you read it. Matter of fact, it's posted on our website, libertydollar.org, and I ask you, Larry, go and read the 35 pages and ask yourself, what is the crime? It points out that I sold a T-shirt.
Let me go to...
Sold a T-shirt.
We've got some sharp-eyed, sharp-elbowed investment strategists here. Quentin Hardy, I want to get your take on this. What's wrong with a little gold and silver behind our money? Remember The Wizard of Oz? That whole book was written. It was an allegory against the gold standard. And what about the Federal Reserve and the Treasury? You yourself just said they're destroying the U.S. dollar. You should be in favor of this.
Everybody should be in favor
of this. Is it true you have a picture of Ron Paul on this currency?
All right, don't ask me. Absolutely. Bernard, is there Ron Paul? Is this Ron Paul money?
Absolutely. We're doing a Ron Paul
right
dollar.
Right away.
Doing
right away, I'm glad they raided you, okay? Now, did you just say 12 G-boys? I'm also glad they raided you.
I thought you were a libertarian, Quentin Hardy. I thought you were
Ron
a libertarian.
Paul, Ron Paul's happy. Ron Paul's happy they raided us, too.
All right, so
with all respect, you are a counterfeiter, okay? What you are doing is undermining the value of American currency. This is not cool. And with a nod and a wink, you can say, oh, it's just a barter thing. It's not really a dollar. But the fact of the matter is, for those who feel that gold is real money and what the Federal Reserve prints is fake money, they take it as real money and try to substitute it. Now, the feds take rather a dim view of people trying to undermine our national currency.
All right.
I'm sorry. And we'll test it out in court.
Jason Trenner, what Quentin just said didn't sound all that bad to me. What's your take? I mean, if people think the Fed is printing, maybe the Fed's money. Maybe the Federal Reserve notes are counterfeit, Jason. This is like a whole new ballgame. What's your take? Well, this could drive it down to 25,000.
We already know. We already know the Fed money is bad.
All right, go ahead.
Just look at the statistics.
Go ahead, Jason.
I guess my take is candidly, I'm a little surprised that Quentin works at Forbes magazine, because I kind of agree with you, Larry. I think we should be free to choose. I'm a Milton Friedman guy.
Yeah. I want to get paid in dollars, not canned food and make-believe money.
I think this is a strong dollar story. You know, you have Gisele Bündchen wanting anything but dollars. You have Jay-Z flashing around here.
We're out of time.
This is actually a new dollar.
Bernard, call from jail.
Has anyone
happens, you can call
man?
Me collect.
Does he stand for anything?
Have me back
Quentin Hardy,
out
you
of
can
jail,
always
okay.
call me collect. Joe B., the same for you. David Kotok and everybody. I don't know. A little silver and gold. It sounds like the yellow brick road to me. Whoopee, Dorothy. Up next, my last word.
Okay, well, interesting report there. Just how you can claim that Mr. Von Nothaus is undermining the U.S. dollar when it is the Fed itself which undermines the U.S. dollar and has undermined the U.S. dollar since its inception by progressively delinking it from anything of value and then printing it into oblivion by the creation of more and more and more and more dollars, undermining its value. That's undermining the currency. That's what the Fed does. So it's pretty amazing that anybody who poses himself as a financial expert could make such claims. We also have a report from National Public Radio. Now, I usually refer to them as National Propaganda Radio. No fan of NPR and haven't really had a chance to listen to this one yet. But here is a report from National Public Radio on the Bryant Park project called The New Counterfeit Money, a report on the Liberty Dollar Raid.
Last week there was a story that just fascinated us here at the BPP. Federal agents reportedly raided the offices of the Liberty Dollar. This is an alternative currency advocated by libertarian activists. Now, we looked at these coins online, and they look a lot like a U.S. mint coin. There's Lady Liberty on one side, and there's a torch on the other, but there's some crucial differences. You have to look closely. It says, trust in God, instead of in God we trust.
Okay.
And the makers claim that these Liberty dollars are backed up by gold and silver. Not so much the U.S. dollar anymore. The man behind the Liberty dollar, Bernard von Notthaus, says once this gets to court, he plans to, quote, put this country's monetary system on trial. Well, here at the BPP, we're not exactly ready for a trial, but we had a lot of questions about this. At what point does making a few coins become an alternative currency, and at what point does that become illegal? Well, we discovered calling around there's very few people who know the answers to these kind of questions, and we found one. His name is Walker Todd, former Assistant General Counsel and Research Officer at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, and he's currently a research fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. Hi, Walker.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing good. We had some questions here. I mean, first of all, have you ever seen one of these Liberty dollars?
Yes, I have.
You've actually handled it or just seen it online? Or?
Yes, one was given to me, and so I've actually seen it, yes.
Now, according to a seizure warrant that the Libertarian group had posted online, Liberty Dollar folks are under suspicion of mail fraud, wire fraud, money laundering. What do you make of this whole situation?
The response of the government this time is interesting and large, and I think the Treasury must be taking this very seriously for whatever reason they decided that this had crossed whatever lines that they had tolerated in the past from private currency issues. So they, I think it is a fairly serious effort. If, reading the news accounts about it, it does appear that the authorities have made a major effort to shut down the business operation, at least temporarily.
Sure, sure. And in the affidavit, they sort of say that it's so similar that it's almost counterfeiting. But it made us wonder: is the federal government the only people who can actually mint coins? I mean, can't we do this in our backyard?
Right. This turns out to be the $64 question in this whole affair. You've all seen ads for the Franklin Mint and other private mints that will stamp out coins that are in about the same size and shape of a
commemorative
dollar.
Coins, yeah.
In essence, that's all these things are. The difference is that Franklin Mint coins, for example, would not be intended to circulate as currency, while it's very obvious that the promoters of the Liberty Dollar do intend that it circulate as an alternative currency. And that's, I guess, what attracted the Treasury's attention in this case.
Well, Walker, last night I was busy minting my own coins. Here, you can hear this right here. I made a Bryant Park Project currency, and on one side it says Bryant Park 2007, and there's
Sorry, sir. We apparently have a lot of time on our hands.
We did. I just wanted to see if you could do
it. We're making false currency.
It's not false currency. It's alternative currency.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It says Bryant Park on one side. It has a picture of our host, Allison Stewart. On the other side, it says BPP $1, and there's a picture of our outgoing host, Luke Burbank, making it a collector's item. So did I break the law by making it's bigger than the dollar? It doesn't look like a dollar, but I called it a dollar.
Right. And that also is one of the things that will attract the Treasury's attention.
What?
The idea is if you call it one of the coins or fractional coins of the United States, the same name, dollar in this case, it's going to raise other issues. Suppose, for example, you had only stamped on it 1 ounce of fine silver, right, and you left off the denomination. Then you might have been within the edges of what the law would allow. But you raised an important earlier question. The federal statute, depending on how it is interpreted, seems as though it might prohibit the minting of any coin of the same size and shape as a regular U.S. coin, regardless of whether it says dollar on it. And that's an eyebrow raiser because it does seem like a total prohibition of any private minting effort
Sure, and if they have a copyright on the shape round, you know, that's pretty much what you expect a coin to be.
I also can't call it a coin exactly because that would lead people to think that it's intended for circulation against U.S. currency and things of that sort. So you have to call it a round or something else that's not a coin.
Well, you know, there are a lot of alternative currency systems out there where people can actually use them for goods and services. I remember one in Seattle. There's one in the Berkshires, in Ithaca. And these are various forms of basically time dollars, IOUs, that people can do public services and get these coupons and then use them to buy things. I mean, they're functionally money. Is that legal?
I used to think so prior to this, but... And they, for one thing, they don't call them dollars. In Ithaca, for example, I believe they call them hours, related to the concept that you work for an hour, you earn the value of a coupon worth X dollars in Federal Reserve notes. And so the currency there is stamped Ithaca hours. And so it's harder to confuse those with regular U.S. dollars.
Sure, and what are they called, Burke Bucks? Or
Berkshires.
Berkshires, something like that.
Berkshires.
So it seems like a lot of this is really the power is in a name and an illusion, because after all, I mean, money is sort of a collective illusion. Walker Todd, former assistant general counsel and research officer at the Federal Reserve Bank, you're currently the American Institute of Economic Research. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Now I know why there's only about five people who can understand it.
Exactly.
And know what to do.
Exactly. Well, you can look at these Bryant Park Bippies.
Bippies, is that what we're calling it?
Bippies. You can look at the Bippy online. We have it up on our website now. They are attractive. And if you want to buy one, it goes for a dollar.
I don't know if I like having my face on a Bippy.
That's why we wait until people die before we put them on coins, because nobody likes the way they look on a coin.
Coming up on the Bryant Park Project, a super secret poll done in Cuba about what Cubans think about the current government. The results, surprising. The methodology, interesting. We'll find out more. Stay with us. We'll be back in about...
Okay, so there you have it, a report on National Public Radio. Pretty interesting that an expert from the Fed himself is unclear on the legality of all of this, and at one point states that with regards to alternative currencies, of which there are many, including the Disney dollar, the Berkshires, which they cited there, was asked, well, you know, are they legal? And he says, I used to think so until this case, which really shows that it is the enforcement through the use of brute force that law is made in an unconstitutional republic, which we live in right now, in an unconstitutional quasi-dictatorship. Not a constitutional republic. It is not the law that matters. It is law created through coercion, through the use of force. So by shutting down the Liberty Dollar, they in fact create law by this action in and of itself. So especially if it stands up in court, which it probably will, of course. So that's what's happening here. Very, very interesting to note the process that we are under here. On that note, I would like to play this piece of the hearing on the Homegrown Terrorism and Violent Radicalization Prevention Act. This is in the House of Representatives, I believe, a recent hearing on the theme of homegrown terrorism. It's about a 10-minute clip. And we'll go ahead and play that for you. It's pretty bone-chilling to see how they are right now setting up the precedent, setting up the mental construct, as it were, of homegrown terrorism as a de facto issue. Now, there isn't any homegrown terrorism. It barely exists. It exists less now than it did in the 1960s. It is less of an issue now than it has been in quite a while. There's virtually none of it. Yet, through this legislative process, and just simply by speaking of it as if it were an actual legitimate existent issue, they're thereby creating it and putting it on the national agenda, something that just frankly doesn't exist. Homegrown terrorism and a phenomenon that they are now calling violent radicalization. The theory being that there are all these people out there that are being violently radicalized via the internet, and somehow or another being transformed into homegrown terrorists through propaganda or what have you. This is simply a concoction, simply a concoction to move us further and further down the slippery slope to police state. So let's go ahead and listen to this chilling comments in as they speak of this as if it actually exists.
Good morning. I expect it will be a useful starting point for us to develop strategies to thwart homegrown terrorism. Welcome to you all.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Other members of the subcommittee are reminded that under committee rules, opening statements may be submitted for the record. I welcome our panel of witnesses. Our first witness, Dr. Bruce Hoffman, is well known to
this
me.
This is Jane Harmon. Jane Harmon, representative from California, terrorism. Speaking, chair of the committee.
In fact, he has been studying terrorism himself for 30 years. Should have been enough time to solve this problem, Bruce. He is currently a tenured professor in the Security Studies program at Georgetown University's Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service. He previously held the corporate chair in counterterrorism and counterinsurgency at the RAND Corporation, which is where I met him, and was also director of RAND's Washington, D.C. office.
He holds the theme of this is terrorism and the Internet.
A doctorate from Oxford. Dr. Hoffman is the author of the book Inside Terrorism. Our second witness, Rita Katz, is the director of the Search for International Terrorist Entities Institute, or SITE, for short.
So the witnesses, so to speak, that they have here obviously have a vested interest in the existence of terrorism, since it's apparently their profession to write and speak about it.
Officials, including former terrorism czar Richard Clark and his staff in the White House, as well as investigators with the Department of Justice, Department of Treasury, and Department of Homeland Security on the financing and recruitment of networks of the terrorist movement. She's the author of Terrorist Hunter. I'm outing her because the author of this book is called Anonymous. Terrorist Hunter, the extraordinary story of a woman who went undercover to infiltrate the radical Islamic groups operating in America. And following her testimony, in fact, following the testimony of all of our witnesses, we will show a short video that she has assembled that includes some of the information that's on these sites. I thought that would be useful for our members and also for the audience that's physically here or watching on television. And let me say, parental discretion advised. Our third witness, Perry Aftab, is an internet attorney and was one of the first lawyers to practice internet law shortly after the creation of the World Wide Web. Ms. Aftab founded America Online's Legal Discussions, as well as the Court TV Law Center's Legal Helpline, providing legal information and education to thousands of lawyers and consumers worldwide. Ms. Aftab previously served as head of the U.S. National Action Committee for UNESCO's Internet Safety Project and the Worldwide Internet Society's Societal Steering Committee. Her book for parents about online safety has been adapted for worldwide use and has been translated into several languages. She's also worked with law enforcement agencies worldwide in the areas of cybercrime prevention, cyberterrorism, law enforcement, and security matters. Our fourth and final witness, Mark Weitzman, is the director of the Task Force Against Hate and Terrorism with the Simon Wiesenthal Center and the chief representative of the Center to the United Nations in New York. Mr. Weitzman was also the founding director of the Center's New York Tolerance Center, and as a recognized expert in the fields of extremism and cyber hate, he has lectured and worked with various groups ranging from Congress, the UN, the EU, and the U.S. Embassy in Berlin, to the U.S. Army and the FBI. He has also chaired the Working Group on Internet and Media Issues at the Global Forum on Anti-Semitism that was convened by the Israeli government in February 2007. The task force coordinates the center's research and activities on extremism, intergroup relations, the Internet, and hate crimes. Without objection, the witness's full statements will be inserted in the record, and I would ask each of you to summarize your statement in 5 minutes or less. There is a clock that I am quite certain is visible to you, and it will start blinking as you near the end of your 5 minutes. We'll start with Dr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify before you on this important issue today. Terrorism has long been understood to be a violent means of communication. The terrorist act itself is thus deliberately designed to attract attention and then, through the publicity that it generates, to communicate a message. But communication is essential for a terrorist movement, not just to summon publicity and attention, but also to promote its longevity and ensure its very survival. Without an effective communication strategy, a terrorist movement would be unable to assure a continued flow of new recruits into its ranks, motivate and inspire existing members, as well as expand the pool of active supporters and passive sympathizers from which terrorism also draws its sustenance. Given this constellation of requisite sustainable resources, it is not surprising that terrorists today devote so much time and energy to their communications, that they have fastened on the Internet as an especially efficacious vehicle for this purpose, given its fundamental characteristics of rapidity, ubiquity, and cost-effectiveness is not surprising either. Today, virtually every terrorist group in the world has its own Internet website, and in many instances maintain multiple sites in different languages with different messages tailored to specific audiences. Accordingly, today there are in excess of some 5,000 terrorist and insurgent Internet sites worldwide. The ability to communicate in real time via the Internet has enabled to reach a potentially vast audience faster, more pervasively, and more effectively than ever before. The implications of this development have been enormous. The Internet, once seen as an engine of education and enlightenment, has instead become an immensely useful vehicle for terrorists to peddle their baseless propaganda and manifold conspiracy theories, as well as summon their would-be and actual followers to violence. These sites alarmingly present an increasingly compelling and indeed accepted alternative point of view, a parallel reality that is presented to the terrorist variegated audiences. Indeed, the Internet's power to radicalize, to motivate, inspire, animate, and impel radicals to violence has already been repeatedly demonstrated in the United States, Europe, the Middle East, and Asia. The process of radicalization, abetted, facilitated, and encouraged by the Internet, however, is only one side of a coin that critically also involves terrorism subversion. Consider what we have learned about the foiled August 2006 plot to simultaneously bomb 10 U.S. airliners and crash them into targets over American cities. This plot was derailed after arrest in Pakistan once more led U.S. and U.K. officials to yet another terrorist cell of British Muslims of Pakistani heritage. The operations controller was none other than Abu Ubaid al-Masri, the commander for al-Qaeda in Kunar province, Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda may thus be compared to the archetypal shark in the water that must constantly keep moving forward, no matter how slowly or incrementally, or die. In Al-Qaeda's context, this means adapting and adjusting to even our most consequential countermeasures, while simultaneously searching to identify new targets and new vulnerabilities and continuing to replenish its ranks with new recruits as well as sympathizers and supporters. In sum, Al-Qaeda's capacity to continue to prosecute this struggle is a direct reflection of both the movement's resiliency and the continued resonance of its ideology and the effectiveness of its communications. Today, Washington has no such program in the war on terrorism to counter effectively these communications and propaganda. America's counterterrorism strategy continues to assume that America's enemies, be they Al-Qaeda or the insurgents in Iraq, have a traditional center of gravity. It also assumes that these enemies simply need to be killed or imprisoned so that global terrorism or the Iraqi insurgency will both end. Accordingly, the attention of the U.S. military and intelligence community is directed almost uniformly towards hunting down militant leaders or protecting U.S. forces, not toward understanding the enemy we now face. This is a monumental failing, not only because decapitation strategies have rarely worked in countering mass mobilization, terrorist, or insurgent campaigns, but also because al-Qaeda's ability to continue this struggle is ineluctably predicated on its ability to attract new recruits and replenish its resources. The success of U.S. strategy will therefore ultimately depend on our ability to counter al-Qaeda's ideological appeal, and thus depend on our ability to counter al-Qaeda's ideological appeal and resonance of their message, their continued ability to attract recruits to replenish
their... Washington Journal continues.
Well, Brian, it's a great honor to be with you. I wrote an article in WorldNet Daily in which I'm discussing this new presidential directive. It was a national security and homeland security presidential directive. And Brian, what it did is it defined a national emergency in a very broad term, the ability to declare that a national emergency existed, and then assumed the president the ability to declare the national emergency, which is all national essential functions for continuity.
Because 38% of Republicans are Southerners, so he has to play down there. But let's don't forget my man Ron Paul here. I talked to someone very, very sophisticated about New Hampshire politics. Money as Giuliani and Romney.
He can.
Washington Journal continues.
Well, Brian, it's a great honor to be with you. I wrote an article in WorldNet Daily in which I'm discussing this new presidential. It was a national security homeland directive. And Brian, what it did is it defined...